Today is March 1st, 2021. This is part 15, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Last time, you talked about how the air quality studies moved along through the Regional Air Partnership, Western Regional Air Partnership, and then the Western Governors Association got involved, and then your work putting air quality into the fire management plan. Do you want to pick that up then?
Okay. Yeah, I thought the fire management plan was, of course, the most obvious thing where air quality figures into how you manage fires in the parks. And so that was a pretty big section. And I had, I think I mentioned before, I'd tried to take a lot of the different techniques and that sort of thing that we'd worked out since the mid-90s in terms of managing the smoke impacts from wildland fire into preserving air quality in the park as best we could. And in doing so, we were both the fire folks and I were also looking forward to some of the changes that we knew were coming down the pike in terms of better instruments to drag around and measure just how bad the impacts were at different locations. I'd mentioned the data rams that we were using that were portable and not much else. But, you know, we had better instruments on the horizon, and we'd actually experimented with a couple on loan from the Department of Environmental Quality down in Phoenix. I was also trying to standardize things because when fires came up, since we were, I don't want to say making it up as we went along, but we were making it up as we went along. You know, trying to see how this works, see how that works.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to do was kind of standardize stuff so that someone coming in after me would have at least some sort of a recipe to follow.
Okay.
You know, what's important to look at, how are we doing this, and that sort of thing. And I also wanted to try and come up with methods that were a little bit better for getting the results out in terms of visibility. Visibility is measured in a unit called inverse megameters, which no one's ever heard of before. And you give somebody the number, and if the unit's something they've never heard of before, the number is certainly not going to make any sense.
Right.
So I tried to use the air quality index that they use for health effects as kind of a model of how to express visibility. And so we put all that together. I did some modeling and that sort of thing, and got it all plugged into the fire management plan, and I think it went pretty well. It's kind of a long section of the plan, but I think it went pretty well. Unfortunately, I left the air quality job before it really kicked in, before the plan finally got approved, and that sort of thing. So I really don't know how well our intentions for a usable procedure worked out, but I hope it did. And the fire management plan was just one of the different park management plans and park actions that I got involved with. Grand Canyon is kind of a showcase of air quality management, and so we were kind of under the microscope a lot in terms of the parks efforts to improve air quality, but also the park's impact on air quality. And so I got involved in a lot of other management type issues.
Like what?
Sometimes it was as small as, what are we doing with regard to construction in the park?
Okay.
You know, road construction and house building construction and that sort of thing. And that sort of stuff was usually pretty easy. I had a list of what we call best management practices, tried and true ways of reducing the impact of different things, like how tall to pile up your dirt at an excavation site before the wind starts catching it and blowing it.
Oh, interesting. Right.
And things like that. So you know, some of it was just cookie cutter stuff. When we had paving projects one time, I don't remember which road project it was, maybe Hermit Road, maybe some of the village stuff. But anyway, they were going to bring an asphalt batch plant in. And it wasn't going to be located in the park, but it was going to be nearby. And so we wanted to convert the plant from burning fuel oil, which is relatively dirty, into burning natural gas, which is relatively clean. Well, to do that, we had to actually go to the state. And so I called up the state and I said, yeah, you know, we got this road project coming up and we're trying to protect air quality and we want to convert the plant. And they started going on and on and on about all the stuff we would have to do. And it seemed a little bit odd to me that there was so much involved in converting this asphalt batch plant. But as the discussion ensued, I discovered that there'd been a little miscommunication right up front. When I said convert the plant, I was talking about converting it from fuel oil to propane. They thought I was talking about converting it from fuel oil to tires.
Oh.
So once we got that straightened out, the procedure was a whole lot easier.
Oh, good.
to work through. So there were things like that. There was, as part of the general management plan, that was kind of a big faux pas at the time, but as part of the general management plan, you know, for a while we were talking about bringing light rail into the park from
right.
Tucson, and that's why the current visitor center is set up the way it is. It's supposed to be a train station.
Right.
One of three train stations in the park, actually. And there was a lot of pushback from Congress, growing pushback, that eventually stopped that because it was getting more and more expensive the more and more we got into the design phase. But the superintendent at one point decided that he needed to have at least an impromptu or summary statement of environmental impacts of the light rail system versus cars and trucks and buses. And so we got the assignment to do it, and in a ridiculously short time frame, it was like, you know, a week.
Wow.
Or something like that. And so I was literally working round the clock on the air quality section of that. And lo and behold, when I crunched the numbers, it turned out that the light rail was incredibly more polluting than the cars and trucks and buses.
How so?
And that didn't seem right, but under the time frame that we had, I described what I did and I turned it in, and stuff hit the fan. And we never went forward with the project for months and months. And then we got a new chief of natural resources in, and he kind of revisited the plan and said, okay, if we had more time, you know, what would we discover? And it didn't take long to find out that it was kind of like with the asphalt batch plan. There was a misunderstanding early on when I had asked for the number of locomotives that would be involved in the light rail. The number they gave me was actually the number of coaches.
Some of which
were locomotives and some of which were coaches.
Right.
And, you know, so it was a relatively simple fix. I just had to divide the divide the engine emissions by about four, I think it was, and all of a sudden the light rail became a lot cleaner.
Wow.
And another thing came up with the Colorado River Management Plan, where I was, I had kind of two jobs with the Colorado River Management Plan. One of them was the, of course, the plan that I'm talking about was the plan actually to manage recreational use on the Colorado River, not to manage the river itself.
Right.
So it wasn't part of the whole Glen Canyon Environmental Studies / GCMRC or any of that sort of thing.
Right.
And one of the things that I did, obviously, was working on motor emissions.
Okay.
And, so that went reasonably well. I was able to look up, how much does an outboard motor emit? And it was pretty much a slam dunk that a four-stroke outboard would be much cleaner than a two-stroke outboard, and had the numbers to prove that. But then we came up against the jet boats that they use to haul folks out through the lower gorge.
Uh-huh.
And I did the calculations on that, and I don't remember what the problem was, but the emission numbers were really, really high. And it's kind of like, well, the numbers are what the numbers are.
Right.
And so we put it together and, figured it into the impacts. And then the ranger at Meadview, the Grand Canyon ranger at Meadview, called me up one day and he goes, I don't know how you do the air quality stuff, but it seems odd to me. I just went back to my high school chemistry and talked to the guys down on the dock that run the jet boats, and he had figured out how much he'd just done chemistry on gasoline, figured out how much carbon was in the gasoline, and then figured out how much carbon was in the emissions that I had calculated, and somehow by the numbers, the jet boats were putting out about four times as much carbon as they were taking in the fuel.
Oops.
And I said, well, this can't be right. And I don't remember how I solved the problem, where I figured out what the error was. But I kind of suspect that the emissions number I had gotten were for a different kind of jet boat motor or something. But anyway, it was kind of like the light rail system. It was a huge reduction in those emissions.
Hmm.
And the plan had already gone out in draft stage for public review. And so we had to, I had to quick write up an addendum to it. It really wasn't very long, but it was pretty important.
Yeah.
And mailed it out to everybody who'd gotten, copies of the plan. And we had copies to hand out at all the public meetings and all that sort of thing.
It's interesting because when I think about river-related air quality, I think about, starting fires for charcoal briquettes. When you want to grill the steaks. And then the silt banks that are caving in daily with giant plumes of dust in the western Grand Canyon there. And then the helicopters that come land and turn off the helicopter. And then they turn the helicopter back on again when they get ready to fly away 15 or 20 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those are adding, they're small little parts to the air quality out there.
Yeah, they are. And the helicopters, of course, since they're outside the park,
right,
didn't figure in.
Right.
One of the interesting things that came out just as a general sort of air quality thing that I had read about, I knew scientifically, but as I was doing the monitoring work and that sort of thing, became real obvious, was the whole business of visibility and windblown dust and all that sort of thing. And the most of the visibility impacts that you see in the air are the result of little particles in the air. The particles are too small to see, but they interact with the light waves and create the haze.
Yeah.
And there's two ways of making those little particles that are small enough to remain in suspension in the air for any significant period of time and cause those visibility impacts. One of them is to take bigger particles and grind them down small in one way or another.
Okay.
The other way is to take gases in the atmosphere and condense them. You have the little gas molecules bump into each other or bump into cloud droplets or whatever and gradually amalgamate. And so the two processes start from infinitesimally small with the gas molecules and growing up into a size that interferes with visibility, or starting with something that's really big and grinding it down.
Right.
And the two actually hardly overlap. The ones that grow up get to a size of usually less than 5 microns, 5 micrometers.
That's really small.
The ones that grind down generally don't grind down any smaller than 5 micrometers.
Hmm.
So it's kind of a dividing line in there. But the big difference that happens with air quality, and you can kind of see it in the park, is that the stuff that starts with the air pollutants growing larger is still small enough that it stays in suspension in the air for a lot longer than the dust that grinds down smaller.
Okay.
So we would get these huge, windstorms, and especially in the springtime.
Right.
And the canyon would get hazy from them.
Mm-hmm.
But usually after about a day or day and a half, all that dust would settle out. Whereas the stuff that started out as, gasoline fumes in Los Angeles or nitrogen oxides from a power plant or whatever, would stay in the air for days and days and days and, travel hundreds and, depending on how sensitive your instruments are, you can pick it up thousands of miles downwind. And so those created the really long-lasting impacts or larger geographic areas as well. So that was kind of an interesting thing.
One question I wanted to ask you was just thinking about impacts from across the Pacific. Did that happen at all, or is the Pacific a pretty good filter to, with the currents and the wind patterns that sweep things, south and north, not just east and west?
That was an issue that was just starting to appear, as I was starting to disappear from air quality.
Okay.
And when it first came up, my initial reaction was that it was bogus stuff coming from the industrial folks trying to cloud the issue.
I see. Okay.
And but as time went on, it became more and more obvious that no, this was really happening.
Hmm.
And what happens is that it's not like a plume of air pollution that's crossing the Pacific Ocean from China or wherever and hitting the United States. Instead, it is eddies, these pressure systems where the swirling creates a pocket of air.
Hmm.
And then in that pocket of air, as it swirls its way across the Pacific, it brings stuff over.
Okay.
And by the time I was, finishing up at Grand Canyon, air quality, it was, we still didn't have a handle on how much of the pollution we were seeing was coming trans-Pacific, but it was becoming more and more obvious that it was a real contributor.
Okay. And, yeah, I was thinking about even just the dust storms in the Gobi Desert. Again, heavy particles that would have a tendency, you'd think, to fall out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the pollution centers in China.
The big thing that we were looking at as I left, and I don't know how the science has moved on since then, the big thing that we were looking at the time was ozone.
Okay.
Because that's a case of there are ways of getting high ozone levels in the lower atmosphere. You know, there's a lot of ozone up in the stratosphere. That's why we don't have skin cancer every time we walk outside, because right. it's screening out the ultraviolet radiation. But down here near the ground, ozone levels are pretty low.
Hmm.
But different air pollutants can combine in the atmosphere with sunlight and create ozone in the lower atmosphere. So lower atmospheric ozone is usually an indicator of human sources. And that's what they were especially looking at, was these pulses of ozone that they would see hitting the California coast
right.
and then moving inland.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And so I think it was around 2008 that you started moving away from air quality.
Right. And there were a couple of things going on. I was still involved with the fire management plan was actually kind of finishing up about that time. But prior to that, I'd started getting a little bit involved in exhibit planning, and geology has always been kind of a hobby of mine. I had like two or three classes in college, so
mm-hmm.
I wasn't a trained geologist, but it went clear back to my first seasonal jobs at the Grand Canyon, where I thought, there's a lot of interesting stories about Grand Canyon, but the thing that really knocks your socks off is the canyon, and that's geology. And so I started crafting my programs around geology and paleontology and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Evening program on evolution, although I never would say the E word as part of the program. I could give an entire evening program about evolution, and if I didn't say that word, people would love it. They'd applaud. They'd come up afterwards and tell me how wonderful it was and go back to their campsites. If I let slip and said evolution, there'd be a group of people with baseball bats lining up after the program to
wow.
whack me.
Interesting.
So I always thought that was kind of amusing.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Then when I was working interp at Yavapai in the mid-80s, the community college, at that time it was the Yavapai County Community College, it was before Coconino got set up, they were offering a class on Grand Canyon geology one semester.
Right, you talked about that.
And so, I taught that class.
Right.
And that kind of gave me the reputation. And then in the 90s, in the springtime, I would take a day of annual leave periodically and teach a day-long geology session for what was then called Elder Hostel, now it's called Rhodes Scholar, programs that were up there at the canyon. So I've been dabbling in geology, pretty much in my off time, but also with the guide training seminars and all that sort of thing. And so interp Ellen Seeley tapped me to help with the remodel of the Yavapai Geology Museum, with the new visitor center and the new bookstore going in. The park was going to reclaim Yavapai as their geology museum, and so I was pretty heavily involved in that work, and it was a lot of fun, working on the exhibits, coming up with what we wanted to say, how we wanted to say it,
nice,
and that sort of thing. We had a team, excellent team, actually from Harper's Ferry. The Park Service Interpretive Center,
yeah,
that was working with us on it. And it was, in the beginning, it was a bit of a challenge, because the Park Service, and in my opinion, rightfully so, gets dinged a lot for trying to simplify stories. Sometimes sometimes they do it well, and they make whatever they're talking about more accessible to the general public. And sometimes it's not done quite so well, and you can really call it dumbing it down. And we didn't want to do that at Yavapai. We said, you know, this is our big chance to talk about one of the world's greatest geologic wonders. We're not going to start out with, what is a rock?
Right.
And it took a while to get the Harpers Ferry team on that wavelength.
Okay.
But we eventually did. And we were, you know, quite pleased with the outcome. We thought that, you know, we struck a good balance. I look back on it now and think, oh, yeah, you know, at one point I was working on text for the exhibits, and I just decided, you know, what is the story we want to tell? And so I sat down at my computer and kind of a stream of consciousness geology of the Grand Canyon
cool.
thing that I wrote out. And then the writer editor that we had on the team took it and took out about 3/4 of it to create the exhibits. But he was good. He knew which 3/4 to take out.
Okay.
And now I look at the exhibits and kind of thinking, you know, he did a really good job of distilling what I wrote, but it probably should have been, it's still pretty text heavy up there. We probably could have taken out some more, but you know, anyway,
yeah.
We were happy with the outcome. And, so I'd been working with Interp kind of on the side on some of these different projects. Meanwhile, the air quality program was kind of winding down, a lot of the projects, you know, the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission had morphed into the Western Regional Air Partnership, which was gradually subsumed into the Western Governors Association, and so I wasn't too involved there. And a lot of the planning processes that I had been involved with the state of Arizona were kind of reaching their conclusion. We'd come up with our state implementation plan for managing regional haze, which was a big stakeholder. I got stakeholder meeting. I got to make lots of day trips down to Phoenix to talk there. And as I said, it was I was a known quantity, and I was relatively local, so it made it a little bit more palatable.
Right.
I know one day I came in and told the director. You know, it's kind of like, Nancy, I'm so sorry. I come to these meetings, and all I ever do is whine about, you know, haze at the Grand Canyon, and what are you going to do about it, blah, blah, blah. And she says, oh, no, I love it when you do that, because you come in and whine about the haze, and then the smelters come in and whine about the regulations.
Hmm.
And so I get to pick a very statesman-like middle course between the two, and it makes me look great.
Oh, know? Good. Yeah. Yeah.
So that went well. The park, or the park service, over the years had never really gotten an increase in funding to support all of this work that we were doing, all the monitoring and the planning and that sort of thing, and yet costs were going up. I mean, you know, our salaries were going up and. Contracting costs were going up, utilities were going up, and so the Park Service was actually having to cut back on monitoring. We were starting to discontinue some of the monitoring programs that were going on in the park. And so it wasn't like I was jumping a sinking ship or anything like that, but it wasn't quite as stimulating as it had been before. And so in 2008, it was the design stuff for the visitor center was coming up, and I'd been talking to Interp, and we decided to kind of make a trade, and I would become an exhibit planner for interpretation, and use some of this, 20 years of experience at Grand Canyon that I had, or however long it was, and start doing that instead. And,
did that move you out of the science center then? Did you change bosses? Okay.
Yeah, I moved out of the science center. There were a couple of projects. I had an assistant at the time, and Bernana Brew, and he was there a little bit longer than I was.
How do you spell their last name? First name, last name?
A B R. I think that was A B R E A U, if I remember correctly.
First name?
Arnan, H E R N A N, with a little accent.
Got
over
it.
The A.
Okay, thank you.
So yeah, he was my assistant, and so he worked. He did a lot of the actual data collection. And so as I left, it was kind of like, okay, the monitoring systems that we still had going, he could take care of those if he ran into any problems. Why, I was just down the hill. At the time, we were doing a big emissions inventory in the park, trying to find out how much air pollution was generated within the park. And this was, gosh, I believe it was the third inventory that we'd done. The first one was done in the early years of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission, and was pretty much done by a contractor, so I was running around trying to come up with numbers to feed into their computer models. This one was one that was run by the Park Service, by the Air Resources Division, and I had already started working on that, and so so even though I switched over to INTERP, I finished up that project, and at least at the beginning, I was kind of providing help and advice and that sort of thing from afar.
Right.
Didn't work out quite as smoothly as we hoped because Anand and Demi got new jobs, and so he transferred out a few months after I left. And so they were kind of scrambling to find folks that could maintain the monitoring network. And as I recall, I did occasionally pitch in and go out and do you know just some of the grunt work to make sure that data stream continued.
Things there were going to get worse. I think there was a multi-million-dollar settlement that required Grand Canyon National Park to pay a concessioner many, many tens of millions of dollars for deferred maintenance. I'm not sure if that's the right word. And money was sort of, programs were being slashed everywhere to help pay for that.
Oh, I know what you're talking, I think. And that part didn't, that part didn't affect me. That came just pretty much right after I left.
Right.
If I recall. Yeah, that was...
Now, it didn't affect you, but did it affect the monitoring? I just wonder, has all that stopped and never revived yet?
The monitoring program, per se, was funded out of the Air Resources Division in the Washington office.
Okay.
As opposed to the park. And... So there'd already been a lot of belt tightening going on, but my position after I left, my position had been just basically the air quality scientist, and I would help out on other stuff, you know, as situations arose, but that was pretty much my primary responsibility, and I was going, you know, like I said, I was dealing with the state, I was dealing with EPA. The Western Governors Association, whatever entity had the crisis du jour, or project du jour, or whatever going on.
Mm-hmm.
But after I left, you know, the decline of air quality issues was fairly obvious. And so they decided that rather than just hire another air quality person for my position, what they were going to do was put them in charge of physical sciences and blend in some of the geological resources, soundscape, aircraft overflights, and all that sort of stuff. So it's going to be a much more broad-based program. And then there would be an air quality technician person to take Ernan's position, but they would be given a little bit more responsibility in the air quality arena. And so it was kind of a my position was broadened and my assistant's position was somewhat improved. But then the funding issue that you're referring to, yeah, that was when the park bought out the possessory interest in the old Fred Harvey facilities that were owned, well, not owned, but possessory interest by Zantera.
Right.
And that really put the kibosh on a lot of things that were going on in the park, because they were funded with some of this fee money. And so the year that the park, and I wasn't involved in it, so I probably don't have everything quite straight, but basically the year that the park bought out the possessory interest, or most of the possessory interest of Zantera in those facilities, the Washington office went through and swept up money service-wide from various programs around the park service that hadn't been spent yet, and plunked it into this huge fund to buy out Zantera's possessory interest. And then Grand Canyon was going to use its fee money over the next several years to pay back those other parks, put the money back in the kitty that had been soaked up by that purchase.
Right.
And that really cramped the style of some of the programs over in resource, or a lot of the programs over in resource management, and also the exhibit work that I was doing for interpretation, because we were relying heavily on those fee monies and that sort of thing to support them. So
yeah.
even though it didn't affect me per se, it really crippled the people who came after me.
Right. Right. When did you retire from the Park Service then? Just trying to put the dates together here.
In October of 2013.
Okay.
I'd switched over to Interp.
Right.
And at the time, we were just talking about the crippling effect of losing all the money.
Mm.
But at the time I moved over, Grand Canyon had all of this money that was coming in from entrance fees and franchise fees and all that kind of stuff. And we weren't spending it fast enough to please the Washington office. And they were talking about not letting the park keep all of the entrance fees that we were supposed to be able to keep.
Okay.
Now, the park had this big backlog of hugely expensive projects, you know, like the Trans Canyon Waterline and stuff like that.
Right.
But the way the rules were set up, we weren't supposed to bank that money. We were supposed to take the money in and then spend it.
Interesting.
Within a year or two or three or four or whatever. I don't know the exact rules. And or we were going to lose it. And so consequently, the park was really scrambling to try and figure out, okay, we've got all these things that we need to do. How can we, you know, obligate this money quickly enough
right.
to do it? And so interpretation had, taken on a lot of upgrades to exhibits and that kind of stuff. And so when I came into Interp, I mentioned we were working on putting new exhibits in the visitor center. We were also working on replacing all the wayside exhibits on the south rim, the little signboards that you see at the overlooks and that sort of thing. We were doing, they had just finished up redoing exhibits out at the Tucson Pueblo ruins out there by Desert View, and we were getting ready to do exhibits in the Vercamps Visitor Center, the ones that were in there that had been put in after the Park Service acquired Vercamps were just temporary exhibits, and so we were trying to plan for the permanent ones going in there. And in addition to that, we had a extensive publications program. We had, you know, we were putting up the newspaper, the guide,
right,
and the park brochures and different different other site bulletins and waysides and this, that, and the other. And so I was in charge of that that project. What we did was, Ellen Seeley was the one who hired me, but she and Tom Pittenger, who was the park editor, were getting ready to retire. And so the plan was that I would come in, I'd work for about a year to learn all the ins and outs of everything, and then a little while after that, they would retire, and I would take over the program. And that's what we did. What we hadn't planned, though, was that the rest of the staff, except for Betty Upchurch, the librarian, and Mike Quinn, the photographer, the rest of the staff also found new jobs. And so at one point, I was down to, like, me.
Wow.
Doing the publications and the exhibits. That didn't last for very long. And so we worked really hard extending seasonal employees and bringing in part-time help and all that in order to keep the program afloat. So we did work our way through all those different projects. But it was a lot of work. I was putting in some really long hours, and some parts of it were a lot of fun, but there was a lot more contracting type stuff than I had anticipated, which I at least didn't think was a lot of fun.
Hmm.
And so it was kind of a case of, you know, yeah, this job isn't exactly what I had planned for it to be.
Hmm.
A lot more contracting work and a lot less technical expertise than I had planned. And so, you know, I talked to my boss, Judy Bryan, and said, you know, I just don't feel like this is a great fit for me. And so we worked out a graceful exit, shall I say. Figured out, okay, well, we've got some of these huge contracts, and we need to get them finished up. And says, absolutely. And so I stayed long enough to finish up the visitor center contract, and that big wayside exhibit contract was almost done. It was we were literally down to the last payment. We got a new writer editor in and had that program up and running. We'd gotten the exhibit plans pretty much finalized for the North Rim Visitor Center and underway for the Vercamps Visitor Center. So so we got, you know, got stuff wrapped up as well as we could, and then I retired. And then shortly after I retired, the North Rim Visitor Center project was completed. And then everything else went on hold when all the money disappeared. So,
right.
So it was.
And Judy, of course, retired, and I think mm-hmm. the new editor writer moved off to a different position.
She eventually moved on. It was. Losing all that the fee money and that of thing. Really made a mess of that whole operation.
Has the park recovered from that? I mean, was that just a few year hit? Because it was over $100 million, I believe, was the settlement.
Yeah, I don't remember what the amount was, but I think you're right. I think it was around. It wasn't so much a settlement as it was a purchase. You know, this is how much it's going to cost.
Right, but I think that didn't Zanterra, the concessioner, submit a bill. The Park Service coughed at it, and they went to court to settle what the actual expense would be.
They probably did. I know Zanterra sued the park a lot.
Okay.
I'm not sure how they arrived at the final price of what they were going to buy and how much it was going to cost. I don't think that I'm positive at the time that the entire possessory interest of Zanterra was purchased out. The park acquired all the historic buildings, but I think some of the housing may still be, Zanterra has the possessory interest on it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
That would be something someone in concessions would know about.
Right.
But yeah, it was, I think it was around $100 million.
Yeah.
And
I'm not sure if the park has recovered from that yet. I mean, I know they were borrowing money from Department of Interior, besides pulling funding from all the parks as well. It was a lot of money.
Yeah, it was a lot, and it runs in my mind that money has been paid back. But the other thing that's happened, if I'm not mistaken, and now this is stuff that I don't have specific knowledge on, is that they changed the rules on banking money.
Okay.
And so the park has in some way or another managed to get a commitment for the funds for the Trans Canyon Waterline.
Right.
And that was always the big black cloud. I don't even want to say on the horizon because the pipeline breaks all the time.
So right.
It's not a big black cloud on the horizon. It's pretty much overhead.
And it sounds like the wells in the Bright Angel debris fan at Phantom Ranch, that pumping system didn't work as anticipated.
Right.
As a water source. I mean, it makes sense if you could tap Colorado River water in that debris fan.
That's the problem there.
Yeah.
You can't touch the Colorado River.
Right. Right.
So the plan was to have wells that were too shallow to get Colorado River water, but deep enough to get water soaking in from Bright Angel Creek.
Right.
And the problem is that, if you go across the bridge there at, by the rock house, below the campground, mm-hmm. there's Bright Angel Creek
right.
running through.
Right.
And it's kind of like, if all this water is supposed to be soaking in, why is there water in the creek
right.
all the way down to the river?
Exactly.
And the problem is that all those big boulders, the space between those big boulders on the delta is completely packed solid with sand and silt.
Right.
And that's why there's water in the creek, is because it can't penetrate the sand and silt that's filled the spaces between the boulders.
Right.
So they drilled their test wells, and the water's just not there.
And you may not be able to answer this question. It's a kind of question for the water people, but it would seem as though the water is there in the creek, and they could dewater the creek the last 100 yards, and pump that water up from there. If they wanted to abandon the pipeline and put the water in the creek and keep it in the creek down almost to the river and then grab it from the river there.
Yeah, and they're looking at something similar to that. That's one where the problem with dewatering the creek for that last little bit is then how are the little humpback chubs going to get up there to spawn in Bright Angel Creek?
All right.
It, which is another long-term goal. But yeah, they are looking now at you know, how can we get water out of the creek itself,
mm-hmm.
and do it in such a way as to maintain the flow across the delta. And
right, and that's difficult there with flash floods coming down the creek, bringing in lots of sediment. That can choke off your intake structures, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you got to engineer and design for that. So
we always make a big deal about the debris flow that came down and created Crystal Rapid.
Yes,
and we've seen them happen at Prospect and constantly rejuvenating lava. But actually, if you look at the geologic papers that have been written on debris flows in the Grand Canyon, the side canyon with the greatest potential for massive debris flows is Bright Angel.
Great, yeah.
And so, you know, whatever you do down there has got to be done in such a way that I don't even think you could say it can survive a debris flow, but that you can recover from a debris flow quickly.
Right.
And I think that's one of the, you know, I'm not privy to that. I'm just on the outside. I'm one of the general public that writes comments.
Exactly.
On management
plans,
you know. Yeah. But I think that's got to be one of the things that's in the planners' minds is, you know, okay.
Oh yeah.
This can't last. We can't design something that we think is going to last the ages. What we've got to do is design something that we can recover from.
Correct. That's right. Which makes sense. In a changing environment, their Grand Canyon is all about changing over time.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So how do you recover from an event like that?
Yeah.
Did you get
one of the things? Oh,
sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's one of the things that, you know, I get to talk to folks about in the guiding work that I've done since I retired.
Mm-hmm.
I know we had doing a rim to rim backpacking trip for the Rhodes Scholar Program down at NAU one time, and you know, a bunch of folks. It's a lot of them. Their first time backpacking in their lives. And our first night at Indian Garden, we'd gone out, watched the sunset at Plateau Point. We're back, getting ready, having supper, getting ready for bed. When the ranger comes down and warns us that there's a huge thunderstorm cell that's barreling right in on us, and we need to be ready to head for higher ground. As it turned out, it didn't materialize. We had a fantastic lightning storm.
Oh my gosh!
Not a tremendous amount of precipitation, but that was our first night, and we had storms kind of rolling across us for the whole rest of the trip. And we had people pretty well sensitized to the danger of flash floods.
Mm-hmm.
So we were at Ribbon Falls,
mm-hmm.
near the base of the falls. Having lunch, and we were setting up lunch for the folks, but we told them, you know, this is a little box canyon,
right.
And if there's, you know, the first thunderclap that we hear, we can't see a flood coming. So anything that makes us think that it's going to start raining, thunderclap starts raining or whatever, we are out of here fast. So we had just gotten lunch out. And there's this tremendous thunderclap, and the folks were just right there helping us pack everything up and get out of Ribbon Falls. As it turned out, there wasn't a flash flood, but we had them pretty well sensitized to it.
Better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
Did you, after you retired in October of 2013, did you get called back by the Park Service for any special duties doing anything?
No.
Okay.
No. I've gotten, they called me, especially on air quality stuff, to consult as they're trying to get the, they're working on getting the air quality program back up and a little bit more functional and that kind of stuff. So I've helped out with that, talking to different people and providing some of my paperwork that has disappeared over the years or whatever. Oh, yeah, I wrote up something on that. Oh, well, we don't have a copy of it.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's pretty typical. I even get that from Petrified Forest every now and then.
It's interesting. It goes back to the discussions we had earlier on about institutional memory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's still...
And, you know, I've come up and um, I've you know, working for the Conservancy, back when they still had the Field Institute, you know, that I would help on some of the training there, and I did do a few sessions of seasonal training on geology,
okay,
and that sort of thing, working on the new booklet that's out for the Trail of Time. I helped Carl Karlstrom and Lori Crossey on getting that out,
right,
and those sorts of things. So I've been involved, but it's been fairly low key.
Okay.
But up until this year in COVID, I was still doing quite a bit of guiding up at the park, because Lori, my wife, didn't retire until 2019, so we were still living at the park.
Okay.
And it was real easy for both the Conservancy Field Institute and for the NAU Road Scholar Program to hit me up for short programs, as well as doing longer tours, so I could do a day trip, or in some cases I would just spend the morning. I'd go out and walk the Trail of Time with whatever group, mm-hmm. and work for 4 hours that day or something like that.
And all that, the Conservancy shut down all their tours.
Right. Yeah,
and I'm not sure what the scholars are doing.
They're pretty much shut down. They've got a reopening plan kind of sketched out.
Okay.
But they keep having to resketch it. So it's looking like it's going to be probably at least this summer before that starts back up again.
Okay. Yeah. Just quite an interesting thing when a global pandemic shows up.
Yep.
Well, Carl, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this interview series, unless there's something else you want to put in here.
No, I'd say that, you know, we've covered pretty much everything, and I worked for 37 years for the National Park Service, and I can't say that every job was fun and games, but all in all, I think it was a good career.
Yes.
And it's one of those, I know that I've spent the last 14 plus hours talking about me, but it is a case of, you know, there were a lot of folks that I crossed paths with, worked together with, or whatever over the years, and practically all of them were good folks to work with,
mm-hmm.
and it was nice to be working with a group of people that were dedicated to something beyond themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, this has been fascinating for me on my side to learn so much about air quality, which, you know, you don't even think of. You come to Grand Canyon, and like I say, you're looking at the geology, but to see the geology, you got to look through the air.
Yeah.
And and what does that mean if you can't see what you're trying to look at?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's like I told people, it's 900 cubic miles of where rock, you know, we talk about the rocks all the time. I talk about the rocks all the time, but the Grand Canyon is 900 cubic miles of where rock used to be.
Right.
And now it's air.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's very nice. Good way of putting it.
So.
Great. Well, with that, I think we'll conclude part 15 of a 15-part oral history with Carl Bowman. Today is Monday, March 1st, 2021. Don't worry, Carl. Others have you beat.
Oh, good. Probably not many.
Well,
we wound up.
This is good. I appreciate it. Thank you. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much for your participation in this program.
Well, it was my pleasure, Tom. I'm just glad that we finally got together to do this.
Yeah, me too. Hang on a second.